Bet the board.
What do you mean you don't bet?
I mean, I don't bet. You know, I don't care. I don't. I never have, and I never will.
Yeah, right.
I'll bet you $20 I can get you gambling before the end of the day.
You owe me $15,000, pal.
Pay him. Pay that man his money.
It's the Bet the Board podcast.
God likes me. He really, really likes me.
In the end, I wound up right back where I started. I could still pick winners, and I could still make money for all kinds of people back home. And why mess up a good thing?
Here's Payne Insider and Todd Furman.
Welcome into the Bet the Board podcast, College Football Bowls edition. Nope. They're not the biggest games on the slate. We'll be back with you next week for all things New Year's Six, the college football playoff, and everything above and beyond. But plenty of games to get to, and for one of the first times that we've done these bowl podcasts, talk a little theory, peel back the curtain in terms of how the professionals look to approach the postseason. I am your host, Todd Furman, joined normally, as always, by the one, the only Payne Insider, but we decided to give him a bye week, and we welcome in a man who's forgotten more college football than I'm ever going to know. He's been with us every Wednesday throughout the course of the season, the one, the only Brad Powers. And Brad, you know, we tried to sell Payne on the idea of talking Group of Five programs, and he recoiled in disgust when we mentioned things like the Camellia Bowl and some of the other options that we're going to hit on today.
Not only did he do that, but let's also peel behind the curtain. As we record this, it is National Signing Day, and I think Payne has to make sure some of those checks cash for Florida State's incoming recruiting class. Got to keep that momentum down there in Tallahassee.
Exactly. I wasn't sure if he was out making deliveries around the South Florida area, if he had to try and flip guys in the 23rd hour away from the clutches of Mario Cristobal. But, you know, those are aspects of Payne's life that we don't ask too many questions about. We allow him to do his thing and operate accordingly. But we'll get to some of the big games, and one of them will actually be tonight. We break down the South Alabama-Western Kentucky game. But it's where we have a chance to kind of have a candid conversation about things. And I know you probably get a ton of these questions asked through the myriad of media responsibilities you go through. I do as well, about some of the trials, tribulations, difficulties and challenges of handicapping bowl season. So wanted to write up a few questions, send them to you in advance so I don't want people to think, oh, look, we're going to get a gotcha moment where Todd can catch Brad with his pants down. Not the kind of show that we do around here. We like to come in with thought out answers and create a little bit of dialogue. But I think the first question that I have to ask is it pertains to the postseason. I mean, you've been at this a very long time. You've lived and breathed college football. What's the single best piece of advice you'd be able to offer up to some of the less experienced sports bettors when it comes to handicapping the postseason compared to the regular season?
Well, I think you have to have the understanding in that it's completely different than the regular season. I'm a numbers guy, and we can get into that. And I still am, as far as the basis of any handicap is always numbers first. But I rely a lot less on my power ratings for bowls. It's almost an all-inclusive effort where you have to, you know, be looking at the screen as far as who's in, who's out for the upcoming game. Coaching really comes into play as far as, you know, some coaches are really good in the regular season, not so much in the postseason and whatnot. And, you know, some that you think are you know, they're pretty mediocre sometimes with extra time to prep, that they show some of their advantages. Some guys with quirky schemes aren't as good during bowl season when it comes to coaches. But I think all that included, the one word I would use that is most important in bowl season, and it's motivation. And I know the math guys are probably already, you know, rolling their eyes a little bit. Well, how do you quantify motivation? I mean, what is it worth? A half point, 3 points, 4 points? I hear you. During the regular season, you're not in that locker room. You don't know what's necessarily going on. So how do you quantify it? I think it's easier to quantify in bowl season. And it's just not motivation if a team wants to be there or not. Certainly that's a factor. I go back to USC preseason number one, playing in El Paso for a bowl game. Of course they're not motivated to be there. And obviously start with preseason expectations and whether a team lived up to them or didn't. But I think the new realm here the last few seasons, the new trend of all these opt-outs, let that tell you who's motivated to be in a bowl game. Lots of opt-outs by your leaders, your starters. Kind of gives you an indication, Todd, that maybe this team might not be that motivated to be playing this upcoming bowl game.
It's such a different animal now, because for years, to your point, I mean, you'd always look at motivation. You try and figure out, okay, how can I build this into my number? Is it, to your point, a half point here, a full point there? And it reminds me of discussions I used to have with Kenny White talking about revenge. And, you know, what's it worth if a team's lost three in a row to a certain opponent? What's it worth in the NFL if you lose the first game at home the second time coming around? And you can't ever arrive at a perfect formula, but I think it's part of what we always talk about in this business, being part art form, part science, and figuring out the perfect balancing act between everything, that you can't necessarily quantify the absence of one player, cluster injuries, or three or four guys. And we'll get into games that obviously further illustrate that point. But it's such a fascinating discussion. And it almost scares me to ask, because I know how I spend my times once these bowl numbers are out. And I feel like I'm constantly chained to my desk for 12 to 14 hours a day watching these numbers move, even more so than during the regular season. And you're a guy that watches more New Mexico football than probably anybody else, including the friends and family of Lobos players out there. How much does it change your actual schedule day to day for the Bulls? I mean, outside of reading, I mean, do you just feel like you're stuck in the office and you want to make sure that, hey, look, as soon as there's a potential inkling that a player is going to opt out, I got to be willing to pounce. I'm going to bet the game and I'm going to figure out what to do with it later.
Yeah, I mean, during the season, I'm still, you know, in front of a screen for long periods. But you're right. It's just way more reading and looking at screens than, you know, actually tweaking power ratings for this and that. It's just trying to stay in front of the news. And it's not necessarily, oh, I'm going to listen to some gambling podcast talk about bowl games and give out picks or whatnot. No, I mean, I'm following more beat writers that might have breaking news on, you know, a certain, you know, player A is going to be sitting out in this bowl game, or certain player B came down with an injury during bowl practices. It's more following those guys than anything that, you know, takes up a hell of a lot of my time. You know, time when you think you're winding down, you actually are ramping up a little bit when it comes to the time. And you would think 40 games over 3 weeks, thank God it's not 40 a week as far as bowl games, although I, you know, more the merrier. But it you know, on average, maybe during the season, I don't know, maybe I'm spending 10-15 minutes per game on average. And bowl season, it's well over an hour plus on each individual bowl game.
I mean, I've kind of told some of the radio guys out there, they'll ask about preparation, and the closest parallel I can come up with is almost like it's final exams. You've put in work throughout the course of this semester, but unlike some of the problems that you've seen arise, say week three or week five, it's putting those pieces together. It's trusting your eyes maybe more than anything else and trying to figure out the proper evaluation of, if team A is down a quarterback, it is what it is, but where else can they make up for some of the shortcomings? Because we talk all the time about continuity, and if you're not good in the trenches, especially this time of year when timing is of paramount importance, it really puts you behind the eight ball. And that kind of leads me to, you know, my next question. When you look at bowl season so far, we've obviously seen a small sample. I think at last count with the Boca Raton Bowl in the books, it's 11 games. Has anything stood out to you that you feel is potentially applicable going forward, or that's impacted your overall process? Because we know each bowl season, even if you've done it time and time again, it's still kind of a snowflake and you have to adjust on the fly.
Yeah, I mean, ideally, you would want a bigger sample size. So far, it's too small. I will say this, and this is one of, you know, we talk about the handicapping processes and tools you use during bowl season. One of them is you get an early indication, hey, is this conference overrated, underrated? How are individual conferences performing straight up and against the spread? Sun Belt's off to a 3-0 start, both straight up and against the spread, and it's not necessarily that small sample size. Generally speaking, because I have been doing it a while, I mean, the Sun Belt is not the same conference as what it was 10-15 years ago, when it was by far the worst conference at the FBS level. Now, it's better than the MAC. It's better than Conference USA. I think this year it's better than the Mountain West. So it's the second best group of five conference, and we're starting to see some disparities. I just think in overall talent and obviously overall strength of schedule when these teams are facing other group of five teams. I mean, if you don't believe the results, go look and watch some of these games. It doesn't look like, you know, a pair of evenly matched group of five teams out there. I mean, just there are some big talent disparities between the Sun Belt and, for example, and we'll get to it, a conference like Conference USA. The other one, and I think this is more going forward than necessarily blindly betting on any team in any individual conference, and I kind of assume this might be the case, unders are off to a good start, and 7-3-1. But It makes sense to me because we're getting more opt-outs than ever before. We're also, we mentioned it's National Signing Day. Well, I mean, coaches have been on the road recruiting for the last couple of weeks. They haven't been necessarily, you know, game planning and coming up with these creative schemes as far as the playbook goes for these early bowl games. I think with more opt-outs, it creates more of an exhibition type and you get more vanilla play calling. I think moving forward, generally speaking, I think the under, especially in some of these early bowl games, is going to be more of the play, not only this season, but in future seasons.
Which, honestly, Brad, is a complete 180 from what we've grown accustomed to in the past. Because historically, I mean, these were games where players would go out there, let it loose. You saw trick plays. You saw aggressive tendencies. And watching Liberty Toledo last night, I was stunned. You had a 4th-and-1 at midfield. I want to say it was midway through the first half. And you got teams looking to punt and pin there for a net of about 22 yards instead of years past where basically coaches went, hey, we're going to throw caution to the wind. We're going to empty the playbook and we're going to get everybody involved. So whether it's the interim coaching tags that you mentioned or some of the lack of continuity that exists, it's pretty wild to see. And it begs the question, do you see some of these totals get bet down in other games and create a little bit of value as we get deeper into the postseason? But I think all that we've talked about provides, you know, a good kind of marrying of thought process when you look at strength of schedule, you look at, you know, overall conference profiles, you look at the power numbers that you use to arrive at a lot of your investment decisions. You know, how do you factor all that in? You know, do you place more emphasis on that than some of the individual matchups? Or you go, hey, look, Team A couldn't stop the run, but they were in a far superior conference. So from a strength to schedule adjustment, I really don't give a shit. And I'm more concerned about the caliber of competition that they've played week in, week out.
Yeah, I think it's the latter. I care more about the strength of schedule more than before. I mean, obviously, well, this is the first time we're getting non-conference matchups since early in the season. You don't have that data, that sample size at the start of the season like you do now. And it's certainly one, if I'm checking off, you know, I got this checklist. Oh, I got to make sure, you know, before I make a bet in bowl season and when I start grinding away at some of these games, strength of schedule is something that's on the checklist as far as, you know, comparing what these teams actually faced. And I don't think the market necessarily grasps it too well. I'll give an example later in the season that I saw happen to see. It was a couple of SEC teams, Auburn and LSU, were laying what I thought were relatively short numbers against a pair of Conference USA teams that have wonderful stats, Western Kentucky and UAB. Market, I thought, got a little too cute with some short numbers. And what happened? Even though there's probably questionable motivation for Auburn and LSU, because they play far superior strength of schedules. I mean, they just boat raced both UAB and Western Kentucky. And I think a lot of the numbers, the math model guys and the analytics guys, I know they should have it factored into their power ratings, but I'm not sure that they do a good job of it. I mean, they see that YPP margin and all that, you know, they'll quote a bunch of different things, but when it's against garbage competition, that stuff I throw out.
Yeah, I mean, it's a great point because I think, you know, people get so accustomed to kind of reading the market and you get that split second view. You look at a number and go, okay, wait a second. This is raising some red flags. What am I missing? So you begin to dive in and sometimes you try and make a case for the favorite in those kind of games, or you'll try and make a case for the underdog. And then you watch the game play out and it's a friendly reminder to all of us that live and die by our numbers that games don't necessarily take place on spreadsheets. And when you have 300-pound offensive and defensive linemen,
great point,
that run at elite speeds matched up against guys that are 250 to 255 in the trenches, some of the analytics don't carry through in terms of brute physicality. And it's kind of one of those things that you always look to try and figure out between the haves and the have-nots, more so in college sports, obviously, than the NFL, because we know there's not nearly the same divide between team one and team 32, perfect illustration, the Houston Texans and the Kansas City Chiefs this past weekend, as what you grow accustomed to with an SEC team matched up against some of those group of five opponents, which I guess provides the logical follow-up then when you're looking at bowl games. When these numbers open up, we see a ton of volatility. We don't know who the opt-outs are early on. Do you take as aggressive an approach when those numbers are out first thing like you would on a typical Sunday morning during the regular season? Or is it a little bit more, hey, look, I need to wait and see to make sure I know what some of these rosters are going to look like? Well, so many of them are truly in flux.
I'm aggressive. I still use my power ratings just to get an idea of how far off the market, you know, what it it kind of depends on what book. I mean, we're getting in the weeds here. Who am I betting into? Is it, you know, against a sharper book like Circa, or, you know, more of a square book? I still use my numbers. I made 40 bets, I think, on that Sunday when they were coming out because I thought they were terrible. So I'm not afraid. Now, that's me. The regular person, I'd probably be a little bit more cautious. And you'll hear me preach all season, and we can get it more into this, but I always preach, get the best of the number, get the best of the number, get the best of the number. I think in bowl season, particularly what's been going on the last 4 or 5 seasons, I think it's okay to wait a little bit and let guys like myself tell you, you know, what the right side is, or the opt-outs, the transfers, the coaching carousel. Let that kind of, you know, get a feel for it for a little bit. And then I'm not saying bet, you know, right, you know, 2 minutes before kickoff, but maybe wait a little bit because things do change, and it's not for everybody, but there'll be quite a few bowl games where I'll bet Team A on December 10th. I'll be betting their opponent on December 29th because of the news information changing, the line drastically changing or whatnot. So it is the one time of year where I mean, I'm on both sides to a lot of bowl games just because of the 24-hour news cycle and the constant changing of rosters.
Yeah, what have you seen in regards to that so far? I mean, we have countless illustrations. You look at, let's take Florida, Oregon State, the perfect example. That number opens as low as 6.5 with a total of 55.5. Anthony Richardson opts out. Price gets ballooned out to 10.5. You see the total start to crash a little bit. And then there's a true back and forth on game day with that number kind of closing 7.5-8 range. Anyone who watched it for four quarters knew that Florida's graduate assistants weren't able to try and put together the same game plan that Billy Napier would have in that spot. And Jonathan Smith, to his credit, used last year's loss in the LA Bowl against Utah State kind of as a rallying cry, a team that was a lot more buttoned up. But on the flip side, I mean, BYU is down to their fourth-string quarterback. They go out there. Granted, they're aided by a pick six for a huge momentum play in the second half, but the market moves SMU's way. BYU gets the cash winning outright as they hold off a two-point conversion late. And then, of course, Fresno State, which saw nothing but one-way traffic, going from a 2.5-point underdog closing as a 5.5-point favorite, and it looked like Washington State would rather be doing anything but playing in that particular bowl.
So my answer to that is always going to be, you know, case by case basis, and whether or not I think there's been some overreactions. You know, let's use some of those games as an example. I wanted to, you know, when the bowl game was announced, I wanted to bet Oregon State. But then, you know, that line got as high as 11. And I thought to myself, my goodness, do I want to lay 11 points for the Pac-12 team who I
have. Brad, have I taught you nothing about Jonathan Smith match in the season?
I should have learned.
From Boise State to Florida. I mean, this is what happens. It's a learning process. It's give and take around here.
I love Jonathan Smith. I didn't necessarily like their quarterback. So I'm thinking to myself, I'm not sure I want to lay, because Jonathan Smith doesn't even trust his own quarterback. He threw, 12 passes against Oregon. Somehow, some way, they find a way to win and cover. But I'm like, you know what? I'm going to take Florida. So I was part of that Florida money. I'm not sure I was racing the window to bet plus 7.5, but and double digits, sure, I'll take the SEC team or the Pac-12 team. I don't care that there's 10, 15 opt-outs for Florida, including Richardson, who I thought was overrated. So that was one I was wrong, but, you know, I took a position that I thought, you know what, there's a little bit too much steam here on the Oregon State side. You mentioned the BYU-SMU game. And maybe it coming down to sometimes when you got opt-outs and whatnot, and look, SMU, their best wide receiver, one of the best group of five wide receivers was out. I thought the market got too cute in the fact that Jaren Hall wasn't healthy most of the year, and I didn't think he was as worth as much of the point spread as the market was making it out to be. And when you got a bunch of question marks and opt-outs, and it kind of goes back to my vanilla play calling, back to basics a little bit, it's going to come down a lot of times to the line of scrimmage. And BYU won the line of scrimmage for a majority of that game. Oregon State beat Florida at the line of scrimmage significantly. That was a surprise there. So I guess what it comes down to is, I mean, when you look at the steam, I mean, so far for me, I've had some winners, I've had some losers. So I don't know necessarily how to answer that. Obviously, Washington State, I mean, it was clear from the get-go that they weren't ready to play. And I would say this. If you're trying to dip your toe in the water, I think it's a perfect in-game situation all year. Like, if you don't in-game bet all season, I get that. I think bowl season, because of isolated matchups, it's the only game on TV at that particular time. There's more books with more outs with different numbers. And you can kind of tell within the first 10, you know, 5-10 minutes of a game if a team's going to be, you know, mentally prepared for this game or not. Washington State, Florida, et cetera. I think it's a perfect in-game betting opportunity. That's the best piece of advice I'd give to somebody.
It's such a great point. And I think for a lot of these smaller bowl games where the casual bettor out there, I know our listeners around here are significantly more sophisticated than the general public, but they may not make it a chore every single weekend to watch teams from the MAC unless they're playing on Tuesdays or Wednesday nights, or try and be as in tune with everything going on in Conference USA. But you can watch a couple of plays, you can watch a quarter, you can watch a half and try and identify some of those in-game opportunities. And it's what I try and reiterate to people, and more often than not, they really don't want to hear it. They want to have action on all the games. Don't bet every bowl game before they kick off, or hell, you don't have to bet every bowl game in general. When it comes down to it, if you're limited in terms of what you have for resources, I know you may not want to spend a lot of quality time with your family, but pick and choose where you're at. I mean, like Brad said, let the professional bettors do some of their heavy lifting first, follow some of the market movement, check some of that line history, and get a better indication of what's going on. And I know we talked a little bit about motivation at the top, and I think the perfect way to kind of bookend some of the X's and O's of handicapping bowls, outside of noticing any particular trends, you talked about unders, and that maybe being something that'll continue not only through this postseason, but what we can look at going forward. Do you have an overall overarching philosophy when it comes to approaching teams with interim coaches based on if they have experience, if they're within the program? I mean, is there anything that new bull bettors can kind of take away when they're trying to assess how a team may perform with a guy not used to calling plays, a guy that's using this as a job interview, or a variety of other situations we see unfold in the postseason that we don't typically encounter during the regular season?
It's a good question. It's kind of changed over the years. When I first started my career, I mean, it was case by case basis. Does the interim coach have a chance at the permanent gig? Was a lot of times the case. I mean, there was a legitimate chance that the guy could be upgraded to the head coaching position. You don't see that as much anymore because these programs fire their coaches in the middle of the season, and you know you have kind of that sample size to look and see how the interim coach is done throughout the course of the regular season. It's not kind of a one game off where the players are excited for the interim or the longtime assistant. I generally think it's negative EV. Maybe not significant, but you know, recent data, I mean, coming into this season, interim coaches were 30-35 against the spread. Nothing significant, but I think the current climate is more negative towards interim coaches. I think there's more likely to have opt-outs when you have an interim coach because, you're making a coaching change. Do I have a spot on the roster with the new coach? Same with the assistant coaches that, you know, they're not going to be, for the most part, you know, they're going to have a job at that place the next season. So they're looking to, do I have to move my family again across the country? They're looking and interviewing for jobs. Signing day, early signing day. I mean, how much time are you allocating towards that between game planning? You're already shorthanded to begin with. So I just think that the uncertainty with today's climate makes me, my original thought process is I want to fade the interim or pass. It'll be very rare where I'm saying to myself, I want to bet on this team for the interim coach because they're excited and he might have a chance at the permanent gig. That's just not the case anymore.
It's one of those things that I wish the NCAA, given the current landscape, would reassess what their calendar looks like, whether it's moving back player announcements into the transfer portal, whether it's moving back National Signing Day. And I hate to use the word integrity because there's not really much of anything left in college sports in that particular regard, but to try and figure out how to preserve at least something as far as the bowl season is concerned. Players want to opt out. That's their prerogative. I don't think anybody should ever be forced to play in this game. It's their livelihood. They should try and protect what they can. But at the same time, I mean, don't encourage these kids to be opting out even before, you know, the day after conference championship games wrap up. And there's so many other things going on. But that's a different discussion for a different day. I think we peeled back a lot of what goes on And there's no better man to talk to when it comes to high volume bull betting and a lot of the things that you'll factor into the equation before trying to figure out exactly how to go about approaching this. And as always, you can follow Brad on Twitter. That's at BradPower7. I'm Todd Furman. You can follow me on social media as well. And most importantly, follow the podcast at BetTheBoardPod. We'll obviously be back with you on Thursday for a little NFL. And of course, the big bull breakdowns coming next Wednesday. But Brad, I'm not letting you get off the hook that easily. We have a couple of games we're going to get to. Not a full slate, a little bit of a truncated edition. And one of those games is on Wednesday night. It is the good old-fashioned New Orleans Bowl from lovely New Orleans, Louisiana. And it's South Alabama taking on Western Kentucky, with South Alabama a 3.5-point favorite in the game. Total at 57.5. Third ever bowl game for the Jaguars, the first since 2016. Kane Womack has done an outstanding job resurrecting the program. A lot of athletes and a lot of talent down there for reason for optimism if they can keep their head coach. The Sun Belt has won 5 matchups in a row against Conference USA teams in the New Orleans Bowl, and that may dovetail perfectly into what you talked about one league trending up and one league trending down. When you look at South Alabama's resume this year, both losses this season came against teams that were currently ranked in the college football playoff, coming up 1 point short, and the Rose Bowl against UCLA as a 15.5-point dog, losing by 4 to eventual Sun Belt champion Troy as a 3-point favorite. You look at the Jags on the offensive side. Carter Bradley spearheaded the attack, more of a game manager than a guy who's going to go out there and try and really light the world on fire. LaDainian Webb, a talented trio of receivers, and the Jags, a little bit of a defensive advantage. Meanwhile, for Western Kentucky, talked about opt-outs. Austin Reed was out, then he was in, then he was out. I'm kidding. And now he's back in under center. Finished the season remarkably strong with 5 straight games, over 300 yards passing. Fortunately for him, he does get one of his top receivers back. But Brad, you look at opt-outs on these two rosters, one team appears to be much more buttoned up, and another is going to be playing a lot of fresh faces at some key positions.
You hit the nail on the head. Let's talk South Alabama. You mentioned it. In a bowl season where there's so much uncertainty, there's so much variance, I like teams that are consistent. You know what you're getting on a week-in and week-out basis. And South Alabama, I can make a case, maybe the most consistent team this season. I mean, going through their schedule, I don't see a really bad performance from them all year. You mentioned the 2 losses to a pair of good teams. Close. They could have easily upset UCLA. Offense, it wasn't great against Troy, but Troy's defense is arguably maybe the best at the group of 5 levels. So I love what they did this year on a game-in and game-out basis, and I expect them to be fired up for this one. On the other side, I have my doubts, and I get it. Austin Reed's in the transfer portal, and then he withdraws, and he's back in. Let me ask you this, Todd. You and Payne took a trip in the middle of the season, took a few days off. maybe weren't looking at the screen, 12, 14, 16 hours a day for those few days. Do you think you were at 100% capacity, hit the ground running that very next day when you returned from your trip? Was that the case for you?
The very next day. I mean, it took me about 10 to 12 days to get back into a normal schedule and routine. I think Payne, honestly, is still recovering. That man can't hold his liquor more often than not. But again, different discussion for a different day. But you're exactly right. I mean, all of these guys, whether you're a college-age athlete or you do what we do for a living, once you break that routine and those habits, it's not as simple as flipping a switch and expecting that you're going to hit the ground running again. You have to almost ease back into it. It's a ramp up. And it wasn't just Austin Reed opting out. You saw a huge exodus of key contributors for Western Kentucky.
Yeah, I mean, 2 offensive line starters. Is that going to be properly priced in the market? No. I mean, you are talking about the 2 most important positions on an offensive line, a left tackle and a center. That's not ideal. Wide receivers out. 2 of their best defensive backs are out. Their top 2 tight ends are out. I mean, to me, that screams that this team isn't, I'm going back to the top. Let the transfer portal tell you if this team is motivated or not. When some of your best leaders and best players are opting out of the bowl game, likely this Western Kentucky team isn't too thrilled to be there, while South Alabama has very few opt-outs and is locked in. So that's kind of leaning towards obviously one way here and where I'm going in this game.
when you look at where this number opened, Brad, we saw some books go as high as 9, obviously under the expectation that there was going to be no Austin Reed. Numbers come kind of crashing down, obviously, as the quarterback is back. We know he is the single greatest factor in terms of moving the needle. From a pure X's and O's standpoint, and when you're looking to handicap a game like this, where do you see the major edge for South Alabama? Do you think it's on the defensive side for them being able to make a Western Kentucky team that's already one-dimensional struggle with that element, or it's what South Alabama could be able to do against a Western Kentucky defense that, quite frankly, was gashed on the ground when they stepped up in class?
I think it's a little bit of both. Now, I probably would have said, you know, Western Kentucky at full strength, you know, I would question, you know, South Alabama's going to get a really tough test here, but the fact that there's so many guys out for Western Kentucky's offense and, you know, with the quarterback maybe not 100% mentally in, I think that the defense for South Alabama is certainly one of the better defenses Western Kentucky's faced this year. And on the other side, you mentioned, I think the weakest unit on the field is Western Kentucky's defense, and with a couple opt-outs on that side of the ball, I look for South Alabama to have a little bit of success there, so it's a little bit of both. I think that they have the superior edge. If all things were equal, and I didn't have these opt-outs for Western Kentucky, I mean, I'd probably be betting Western Kentucky just from a pure numbers perspective, but it kind of goes full circle. You know, I kind of throw out my numbers this time of year. I don't care that my pure power rating has South Alabama by 2 here. I still think there's a lot of value because even the old Brad Powers isn't going to have, you know, well, this left tackle is worth a half point. This second, you know, leading wide receiver is worth a quarter point and stuff like that. I don't go down that road, but I think when you add it all together, it's, you know, 1 + 1 = 3 type of situation here.
You know, and that's what I was hoping for, Brad. I was looking for the granule power rating for individual players. I wanted you to know the full depth chart for both of these programs. And look, I mean, we don't say that obviously disparage some handicappers that do that. I tip my hat to some of those folks. I think sometimes you can get caught up in the minutia, though, to your point. And to use the age-old cliche, you lose sight of the forest in the trees. And in this particular situation, it's not just one player. It's the overall sentiment. And if a lot of guys are opting out, you do wonder about the level of focus and engagement for two teams playing on a Wednesday night a few days before Christmas, knowing that one team came in looking to try and get a program-defining 11th win with one of the up-and-coming coaches in all of college football. From Wednesday night, though, we'll hit the fast-forward button, move all the way to the post-Christmas bowl parade on Tuesday, December 27th. Another barn burner that I know everybody on the West Coast is going to wake up to. First thing in the morning, you know, they're going to go the hell with Boxing Day, the hell with all the great gifts we got for Hanukkah and Christmas. We're looking forward to the Camellia Bowl, and it's Georgia Southern, a 3.5-point favorite at the Crampton Bowl in Montgomery, Alabama, taking on Buffalo. There are some fours in the market, so depending on what side of the equation you fall on, shop around. His total looks as low as 66 as well. When you look at what the Camellia Bowl has been, it's actually been one of the better bowl games over the last 8 seasons, with the first 7 editions all decided by 8 points or fewer before last year resulted in a massive blowout. Both Georgia Southern and Buffalo landed in a bowl game with a win in their last game of the season. And ironically enough, because you don't typically connect these two programs by a common thread, but in this instance, you have one. That's Kyle Van Treese, the former Buffalo starting quarterback from 2017 to 2021. Was actually Buffalo's quarterback in the 2020 Camellia Bowl, back when Buffalo was able to win that. He, of course, now manning the reins for Georgia Southern. Would be just the second game all season where Georgia Southern actually closes as the favorite. Defeated Morgan State earlier this year 59-7 as a 39.5-point chalk. Which, Brad, I don't know if we give credit to Clay Helton for turning this program around, making them competitive, or what to think about a Georgia Southern team who came into the year without high expectations but finds themselves playing deep into the month of December.
Look, guys in our industry, me personally, probably even general college football fans, particularly Southern Cal fans, probably don't think very highly of Clay Helton. I'm here to tell you, I think he did a wonderful job this year. I mean, you mentioned it, favored in very few, you know, one game, and they're sitting here with bowl eligibility. On top of that, you look at what Georgia Southern was as a program for so long, run-oriented. I mean, at times, triple-option offense, and somehow in one offseason, you know, transition the team to a pass-happy offense, up-tempo offense. That usually takes years. I mean, ask Jeff Collins at Georgia Tech how much of the transition was from Paul Johnson. It took years, and obviously cost him his job because he couldn't do it in enough, you know, speed of time. So he did a really good job, Clay Helton, and maybe he's more of his, you know, his neck of the woods as far as his ability is maybe a little bit at the G5 level and not at a blue blood like USC. You mentioned Van Treese. I think he'll be motivated. Obviously played 5 years, made 25 starts at Buffalo, playing against his former team that really didn't utilize his passing ability. Now, he turns the football over a little too much for my liking, but 15 interceptions, but I didn't know that he had that type of passing out of him because I just never saw it from Buffalo. So the one thing that I'll say about this, you know, positive for Georgia Southern as far as getting the ball eligibility, which I didn't expect in the first year under Helton. Buffalo, I did have some expectations for, and they lived up to them for majority of the season. November, though, for them, I thought was a bad look. I mean, especially those last two games are at home. They're going for bowl eligibility. They blow a big lead against Kent State. And then with bowl eligibility on the line in a makeup game against Akron, I mean, they should have lost the game outright as a double-digit favorite. So I did not like the look on Buffalo coming down the stretch where Georgia Southern beat App State, you know, in an upset where the market was so anti-Georgia Southern, they exceeded expectations. So at least on the surface coming into this game, I have much more positive vibes about Georgia Southern.
Yeah, this is a safe space, so I feel comfortable admitting this. I actually watched the entire second half of Buffalo-Kent State. Not quite sure what I actually watched when that game looked to be dead and buried before they let the Golden Flashes back into it. And a game where I honestly think, Brad, there were seven people in attendance watched that game in its entirety between Buffalo and Akron. Had the Zips in that spot. Unfortunately, had them on the money line. Felt extremely disappointed that they weren't able to win that game outright. But yeah, no doubt about it, Maurice Lindquist's bunch looked to be significantly better. Maybe their season peak with that dominant performance against your alma mater, a game I know you and Payne were both on with Buffalo against BG, and then limped down the stretch. Now, for all the positive things we can say about Clay Helton and what the offense has accomplished, obviously Georgia Southern isn't without its foibles defensively. 127th in the country in yards per play, ahead of just Charlotte, Vanderbilt, Colorado, and USF. 130th in total yards allowed, only USF was worse. 129th versus the run, Colorado and Louisiana Tech, basically the competitive subset. And where they were at their absolute best, 114th in the country, allowing 274 yards per game through the air. When you look at Buffalo and what Cole Snyder is going to bring to the table, do you see a path for success for Buffalo offensively? And that should that cause a little bit of concern for Georgia Southern's defense?
Yeah, it certainly does. I mean, everybody's had success against Georgia Southern's defense this year. So there is a pathway here for Buffalo. The one question I would have is, you know, something that's going to, you know, take some further investigation here as we're taping this almost a week ahead of time is Buffalo's running back situation. You mentioned cluster injuries. They were down several running backs down the stretch of the season. That might have been one of the major reasons why they couldn't close games or didn't look good. That is something of a concern where they're not, if they're not 100% at that position, then, you know, certainly they'll still be able to get their yards and points, but maybe not to their full capacity to keep pace with a high power Georgia Southern offense. If you don't, I mean, maybe some of the best defense against Georgia Southern's offense is to just keep them off the field. Well, if you got cluster injuries at running back and can't run the football and are one dimensional, I don't like Buffalo in a shootout here. I'll put it that way.
No, it makes a ton of sense. And when you look at Buffalo, you know, for all the questions that we have about their offensive capabilities matched up against how Georgia Southern can struggle to defend, I mean, Buffalo wasn't exactly a steel curtain on the defensive side. I mean, their run defense was downright dreadful. Barring the Akron finale, I mean, the numbers, 214 rushing yards allowed to Kent State, 300-plus allowed to Central Michigan, 165 versus Ohio, and 198 versus Toledo. So for a Georgia Southern team that it really is balanced and wants to try and get after you on the ground, they want to chuck it around the yard. Let's see if Buffalo is happy to be in this game. And I'm honestly surprised that they actually wanted to win their regular season finale to continue practicing for an extended duration, given how the month of November went. So interesting game, to say the least, when you look at Georgia Southern. A favorite for only the second time this year, a little more than a favorite with one of the higher totals that we'll see in a bowl game, sitting at 67.5. And we'd be remiss, Brad, though, if we didn't cover at least one bowl game that involved two teams hailing from Power 5 conferences. Now, neither one of which had a signature season, given some of the high standards we've seen them set as programs in the past, and that is the guaranteed Rate Bowl at Chase Field in Phoenix, taking place on Tuesday, December 27th, with Wisconsin a 3.5-point favorite. Total on the game sits at 43. You did see this game open as low as Pick'em at some shops, with a total as high as 46. And when you look at Oklahoma State, 6-0 ATS in the past six bowl games that they've played under Coach Gundy. It's tied for the longest active cover streak in the FBS, along with Navy. They're playing in a bowl game for the 17th consecutive season, sixth longest active bowl streak. And Saturday will mark the first ever meeting between Oklahoma State and Wisconsin, the first time the Cowboys have actually faced a member of the Big Ten since they defeated Purdue 58-14 in the always popular and must-see TV Heart of Dallas Bowl to close out the 2012 season. Meanwhile, you talk about bowl streaks. Wisconsin, they are the poster child for consistency, playing in a bowl game for their 21st consecutive season. It's actually the third longest active bowl streak. 7-1 themselves in the last eight bowl games, tied for the most bowl wins since the 2014 season, and they're trying to avoid their first losing season since 2001. They come into this game with a 6-6 record. Unique situation for those folks that haven't followed. Jim Leonard, the interim coach, was offered a spot on Luke Fickell's staff, declined it. Luke Fickell, in an article that was published way back in late November, early December, said that he wanted to have a hand in some of what was going on with their bowl preparation. We'll see exactly what that means. But Brad, when you look at Wisconsin, an uncharacteristically poor performance for them. Oklahoma State limped to the finish, and limped might be using that term extremely generously when you're talking about dropping five of your final seven games after starting the season 5-0. You mentioned motivation early on in some of your bowl handicapping tidbits. Is this the poster child for it, or do we think that both teams come in on a level playing field there, and this could actually boil down to true X's and O's?
So full behind the curtain, where you can't be stuck with one position and be, you know, stubborn. Oh, I really like this team. I mean, within the first few days, I had bets on both teams in this one. Graham Mertz is out. I'll take Oklahoma State +3.5, and, you know, Mertz stinks, but I mean, who does Wisconsin have as a backup? And then right after that, I think within 24 hours, Spencer Sanders is out of this game. He's not going to play. I thought there might be a chance that he would. Okay, I'll lay one with Wisconsin. No problem. I mean, the drop-off from Spencer Sanders, the backups, is more significant than Graham Mertz, the backups. But I included this game. You read my mind. I wanted to throw a bone to the audience, talk about a couple of Power 5 teams. But it also is the poster child for so much uncertainty. We're not just talking, we got a pair of teams with backup quarterbacks. I mean, multiple significant players on both sides of the ball for both teams are out for this game. And I think people probably get a little bit paralysis by over analysis and probably will dive in. Well, who's this backup? Who's that backup? And, you know, how much is this guy worth? And that. I just think it screams NFL preseason exhibition football. I think we saw one of them already this year in bowl season. It was Louisville-Cincinnati. Very similar game.
I don't want to talk about that game. I had the first half under and then watched that thing die on the vine. I was not too thrilled watching that Wasabi Fenway Bowl.
Yeah, so, you know, I was getting, oh my God, I was getting tweets and texts. How can you play under in this game? 21-7, another loser. So I was with you. And then what happened the second half? It died and pretty much played what we expected. So still went under. I think it's something similar here. Don't overthink it. I mean, you have so much uncertainty. You got bad backups playing, a lot of key leaders out. It's NFL, you know, preseason football. And what's with those totals? They're a lot lower than the regular season totals. I'll put it that way.
Yeah, I mean, the one good thing, too, when you're talking about a Wisconsin game, I can't really see a defensive-minded head coach playing with backup quarterbacks. And there's a lot of speculation in terms of what direction that the Badgers will go. Talk that Chase Wolf will get a couple of series as the guy, based on what he's put in for time, a fifth-year senior called upon 12 times as the backup over the last couple of years. But discussion that they could use this as an extended spring practice for Miles Burkett, who apparently they believe in. So you wonder what's going on between the back and forth, between Luke Fickell trying to figure out what he's going to have for players going forward, even if they did bring in an Oklahoma transfer in Nick Evers, versus a guy who's really made a lifelong commitment to being in the program. But regardless, Wisconsin's DNA, at least for now, still remains running the football, and Braylon Allen will be that guy to try and carry the rock against an Oklahoma State defense that, quite frankly, probably didn't get enough credit for how good they were late in the year when they went through the revolving door at starting quarterback. And I know they're without starters, Mason Cobb and Jabbar Muhammad. I don't think it matters if you're down guys in the secondary against the Badgers. But for me, Brad, the one thing that's been wild to watch, the metamorphosis or whatever terminology you want to use for a high-flying offense in Stillwater, I mean, Oklahoma State has held 30 of its last 33 Big 12 opponents under their season scoring average. They've won 81 consecutive games when holding its opponent to fewer than 20 points, going all the way back to September 13, 2003. It's actually the longest active stretch of time in the FBS and longest since 1980. They've held its opponent scoreless on its game-opening drive in 30 of its past 43 games, and they've held their opponents to less than a 50% third-down conversion rate in 36 out of the last 37, including over the past 37 games, holding their opponents to about a 28% conversion rate on third down. So this isn't an Oklahoma State defense that we're talking about, you know, years ago when it was Josh Fields under center and Oklahoma State had to score 60 to ensure a path to success and their ability to win football games.
Yeah, a lot of those are, you know, those stats are under Jim Knowles, and we expected a drop-off for Oklahoma State's defense. And there was. But what I liked is, and it kind of makes some sense, I mean, as they adjusted to Derek Mason's defensive philosophy and schemes, sure, it would take a little bit. You would expect that, especially with a team that lost a lot of key guys from that outstanding defense a year ago. And when it became more put on their shoulders, when Spencer Sanders is banged up and the offense is compromised, that defense, I thought, responded well down the stretch of the season. Where they could have waved the white flag, things aren't going well. I mean, they responded. If you don't believe me, I mean, their last five games, if you're scared about betting an under on an Oklahoma State game, well, you're probably scared of making some money, because, I mean, the five straight unders to close out the season as they kind of leaned on that defense. With that being said, several of their starters are out, including their leading tackler. But again, that maybe that would worry me against a team that's going up tempo and trying to, you know, air it out. You're not getting that with Wisconsin. So I think Oklahoma State defensively, you know, after we had major question marks in the middle of October, by the middle of October, I think they've answered some of them down the stretch.
Yeah, it's such an interesting situation. Obviously, when you look at Oklahoma State, they would have loved to have Spencer Sanders here. You have Gunnar Gundy. You have Garrett Rangel, who's most likely going to come in spring camp with an inside track on potentially being that starting quarterback, but in a limited sample size against some of the lesser teams, at least on the defensive side, didn't exactly go out there and wow. And when you're looking at Wisconsin, we have to look no further than last year's bowl game against Arizona State that took place right here in our backyard. That was the definition of an absolute slog.
Yeah,
a 20-13 win for the Badgers, highlighted, Brad, by arguably the longest march to nowhere on the final drive of the game that allowed the Wisconsin Badgers to cover and keep this game under the total. They took 18 plays, went 90 yards, took 9 minutes and 57 seconds off the clock, and ended up kneeing inside the Arizona State 5-yard line. It's the kind of thing that underbettors dream about.
Were you in attendance?
Postseason success. I was not in attendance any more than I was waking up and making it a priority to get to the Oregon State, Florida, Las Vegas bowl game this year. Were you in attendance for that? Or did you have somebody that was made plans to go to the game, was already in their seat, and you sent him a text message to tell them that you weren't going to be able to make it because the parking situation wasn't favorable?
That was the shot of maybe the year. I love it. No, that was not the case, Todd. I only do that to my good friends.
Hey, I appreciate that. Those are the ones you can leave high and dry. And like I said, we'll have a chance to attend a couple of Vegas Golden Knights games once the workload diminishes a bit for you with college football, the end in sight. You can follow Brad on Twitter at BradPower7. I'm Todd Furman. You, of course, can follow me there. Follow the podcast at BetTheBoardPod. And I forgot earlier, I'll remind all of you, you can follow him if you want, but Pain Insider on Twitter. And this is normally, Brad, the point in the program where I defer to Pain and I give him the floor to kind of navigate the entire landscape and identify what we would define as a true investable opportunity. But he's bestowed that honor on me, so it's a lot of pressure. So as a result, I kind of wanted to flip the script and pull a full 180 and go, you know what? If I'm going to give out a best bet on this podcast, I'm going to make sure that Payne really feels the pressure, because we're going to put the burden of proof on bet number 256 the beloved Florida State Seminoles, and we're going to back Florida State in the first half. -4.5, there are some fives out there, not exactly key numbers there. And it highlights everything we talked about in bowl games. Teams looking to approach the postseason with different levels of motivation, trying to either use this as a springboard for the subsequent season or continue some of that momentum that they've built. And when you look at Florida State's season in a nutshell, at 9-3, I don't think it's outlandish to say by any stretch of the imagination that they were the best team in the ACC down the stretch. And if you were looking to try and handpick the best teams, we would have been treated to a much better ball game between Florida State and Clemson in a little revenge type scenario than we were in the ACC championship. Jordan Travis back on campus in Tallahassee, a massive gain for Mike Norvell as he continues to try and restore the legacy there. And while we're not quite sure if all the pieces of that Florida State defense will be there, what we do know on the Oklahoma side is you want to talk about motivation and some concerns here. Well, Oklahoma is going to be down some of its key cogs, specifically along the offensive line where you've had tackles Anton Harrison and Wanya Morris opt out. You've had defensive lineman Jalen Redmond opt out. And arguably the lifeblood, and this isn't any disrespect meant towards Dylan Gabriel, but Eric Gray, who single-handedly put Oklahoma on his back for stretches this year. So being down some of those pieces, I'm led to believe that they may not be the only opt-outs for the Sooners. And reading between the lines for Brent Venables and some of the comments coming out, I just get the overarching sentiment that this is going to be more of a let's use this as a dress rehearsal and a scrimmage to figure out what we have going into spring practice. So much so that Venables talked about there being only a 6-week window before they actually reconvene with focus on the spring. This, for me, on the outside looking in, has the makings of men versus boys. And while I think Florida State comfortably covers the full game number, we don't love to get in the habit of giving out numbers that are a little past their prime, albeit we laid 7.5 in the game. I think the first half makes a ton of sense, especially if Florida State comes out with a chip on their shoulder, looking to unleash Jordan Travis, and they can run away and hide, much like we've seen in some of these bowl games before with Power 5 teams, where one team comes in with emphasis being placed on the game and another team kind of coming in, seeing it slightly as a reward. And that's even before you factor in the potential home field advantage in the Cheez-It Bowl at Camping World Stadium for Orlando. Do you agree with our best bet, Brad, on the Florida State Seminoles on December 29th?
Love it. I am already involved on Florida State in this game. And you mentioned at the very end something we didn't mention yet. Crowd advantage. Every half point can matter, and a lot of times it might be worth more than a half point in some of these games if there's a significant crowd advantage for one team. Don't believe me? Look at some of the Group of Five teams that had big crowd advantages over the weekend. Fresno State, large crowd edge. That helped them. Southern Miss had a big crowd edge. That obviously at least showed specifically on came across on TV, so expect Florida State close to home to have it. And then you mentioned a lot of it. You know me, I was Mr. Seminole this year, and that wasn't sucking up the pain. I love this team, what I was seeing in the middle of the season. So, I love this play. It's one of my favorite plays of the entire bowl season.
Yeah, it's a team that was trending up. I mean, we talked about them early in the year. We weren't quite sure exactly how some of the transfers would take, but pretty wild when you look back at the college football season in a nutshell and you kind of take a snapshot and you realize how big that game was week one between Florida State and LSU, two teams we thought could use that as a jumping off point. Both teams, very successful seasons, and Florida State a chance to put a final stamp on it against the perennial blue blood. And two coaches, honestly, they're quite familiar with one another. Mike Norvell has gone up against Brent Venables' defense with far superior talent when Venables was the defensive coordinator at Clemson. Don't think for a second some of that level of motivation won't be lost, and he can exercise the frustrations of Norvell's early tenure. So Florida State, first half, have no problems with people betting the full game, but wanted to give out the best available number on the first half. I think anything under that key number of 6, plenty of value there. Brad, we've covered a ton of ground on today's show. We didn't have Payne getting in the way, bogging us down with completion percentage over expectations, EPA, and a lot of that other stuff that gets in the way. Was there anything else that you wanted to share with our listeners? I know we'll have you back next Wednesday and we break down some of the bigger bowl games.
No, there wasn't. I think you well said with that final parting shot on Payne. It was a pleasure.
You know what? I got to take jabs at the guy. I've been doing business with him since 2014. I've had to listen to his shenanigans, and it's even better. When he's not here to defend himself, that's when we can cast dispersions. But we'll be thrilled to get Payne back in the fold next week. We didn't want to bog him down with some Group of Five analysis. I know you and I are more college football diehards when it comes to making sure that the little guy gets proper attention. So best of luck, Brad, with your myriad of bowl games. You said you had bet 40 on the open. I can only imagine with a slate north of 40 that you'll find a way to come up with 500 162 bets across the postseason. So remember, follow Brad on Twitter at BradPower7. I'm Todd Furman. Follow me there. Most importantly, follow the podcast at BetTheBoardPod. Best of luck with all of your postseason investments. And remember, with a Florida State ticket in hand for the first half, we'll be back with you, of course, before this game kicks off. We'll see you at the win.
Thanks for listening to Bet the Board. You can catch Todd and Payne every Monday, Wednesday, and Thursday during football season, breaking down the biggest NFL and college football games. And to make sure you don't miss any free best bets, subscribe to Bet the Board on iTunes, Google Play, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts.